I just hope you enjoyed your breakfast. Whenever you have breakfast, like everything else, you always contemplate Dhamma. Or it's always contemplating loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. Baked beans, yeah, baked beans as well. Whatever beans they may be, admitting that. Now you're not admitting them this afternoon. That's why I usually sit in meditation facing you rather than facing the other way. So anyway, we're going to talk today about non-self, not-self, which is one of the most interesting parts of the Buddhist teachings, but again, it needs some explanation because it goes against the grain. Much of this retreat, in one sense, it's easy. If you follow the instructions, it's nice and easy. However, it's not easy to get your head around because this is something strange, not the usual way that you've been used to doing things. Letting go, taking it easy, that's not the usual way you're supposed to do things in this world. You're always supposed to be striving, so doing something, gaining something. And here, you're going in the opposite direction. That's why it feels a bit uncomfortable. And number two, when I started talking about will, there's no one here anyway, and that seemed really weird. Because to all intents and purposes, it does seem that you do exist. And that's why that you know you still have that sense of identity. As far as you're concerned, that you did choose to come here today, you did choose what you ate for your breakfast, you always seem to be in control of these things. But there comes a time in our life, we call it like, you know, the midlife crisis, or sometimes we call it the mid-retreat crisis. We begin to doubt, what am I doing here? When things seem to be sort of going out of control. See what the midlife crisis is. Now you think when you're young you've got a handle on things, if you work hard, you study hard, you get all this happiness, success, and you think that's what you're supposed to be doing because that's what you've been told by your teachers, by your parents, by society. And there comes a time when you begin to question all of this because you try so hard, and if you fail you try and sort of, you know, try harder next time, or find out why you failed and sort it out next time. But always trying, 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 but whoever you are, we eventually keep failing. Things keep going wrong. And we don't know why. So why is it going wrong? It shouldn't go wrong. That's not what we were promised. Does it mean something wrong with me? There's not something wrong with your controller. But after a while, you have to find a different way of looking at things. Like a paradigm shift. A different viewpoint to actually understand. And get through that midlife or that mid-retreat crisis. Because what one is actually finding out that after a while that one isn't in control. You have like the story of, you know, the Buddha, and it's obviously with those stories of enlightenment, it's not just a historical record, but it's also got a huge amount of meaning. It's an instructive story which we can investigate to find nuggets of wisdom. And according to that story, the traditional story, for 6 years the person who was to be the Buddha really strived. He put everything in to what he was doing. He gave it his 100% full shot, not just for 10 days, for 6 years. And they're doing amazing things like not eating or just sleeping out or whatever, really pushing his body to the limit because his willpower was that strong. He really wanted to get enlightenment and he really tried his very best. And there comes a time when you fail. In those moments of failure, you know, when you've tried everything you've got, everything you've known, your whole arsenal of weapons has been used up and found ineffective. That's always the most interesting times of life. That's where we have to change the way we look at things. We can't change the world, but we can change the way we look at it. And in particular, in the case of the Buddha was striving so hard. And there was one experience he remembered where he didn't strive. And that was a happy time. That was when he got the jhanas the first time. As a young boy, just not knowing what he was doing, sitting under a rose apple tree, just goofing off, having a good time, not doing anything. His mind spontaneously just went into a very peaceful state, easily, with no effort, not struggling, not trying to do it, just happened. And that memory was something which was Very profound. There was a time he went in a completely opposite direction, not doing, completely letting go. He got these beautiful experiences. And so that was the teaser for him, that experience which was could never forget, never put away, but which promised something very deep and profound, but couldn't really understand what. He gave it a try, and of course it led to his enlightenment. And the point is here, to really understand what that letting go truly is, what non-self is, not doing is, we too need to get an experience at least close to that, if not right in there into a jhana. Because what happens is that we find that this path of jhanas is a path of non-doing, of non-controlling, of non-struggle. We trial our life to get the happiness which we think we deserve, to get the success, whatever else it is you want in life. And this is what midlife crisis is you try so hard and you wonder why it didn't work. You play by the rules, you haven't won. What's going on? Same as in a retreat. Sometimes you think, I played by the rules. I've sat, you know, longer than anybody else. I got up really early in the morning, kept all the precepts. Why? What's going on? And this is the point here. You're playing by the rules. You're doing things. But you're not really following the heart of this retreat, which is this letting go, going in the opposite direction. However, this path of meditation leads to peace and happiness. And that is the little carrot which actually draws you along deeper and deeper into this path of understanding non-self. Because the deeper you go in meditation, the less you exist. It's a fascinating little insight there. You've all meditated a little bit. You've all got some peace. You ever notice that the more that you get peaceful, the less you are? A lot of times people measure themselves by what they do. That's why they ask in your passport, what's your profession? Buddhist monk. That's not what I do, that's what I don't do. They ask you, what's your profession? You might say like a home builder or sort of an accountant. And that's why when people get the sack, they get made redundant or they have to retire. They lose a lot of their identity because very often we think of ourselves as what we do. And here, in this meditation, you're doing nothing. When you do nothing, you get peaceful, and none of you disappears. But it's okay that we can allow things to disappear, because there's always a sense of somebody in control. If things go wrong, you can always come out again. If you don't like it, you can always leave. That's why it's not because of monks eating beans that people sit in the back. People love to sit in the back because that's closer to the door. You always feel much more secure listening to a talk when you're close to the door in case you can get out, just in case. Even in Nala Mao, you see the doors are always congregated with people. It's a little safety net. So that we always feel we can come out of this meditation. That's why we don't really mind, just going a little bit deeper to see what will happen. But little by little, the deeper you get, the more peaceful you are, and the less you are. And also you find out the less you're controlling things. And this little way of giving up doing, giving up control, gives you another little sweetie of happiness. It's what takes you deeper and deeper into meditation, and closer into the realization of non-doing, non-self. You start to understand the more you do, the more you will, the more you choose, the more you struggle, just the more you suffer. You're understanding something very profound, which the Buddha put in his Second Noble Truth. The Four Noble Truths about suffering and the cause of suffering. The Buddha said very clearly, the cause of suffering is craving. Craving, craving, craving. The cause of suffering is not having a husband or having a wife or being celibate. That's not the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is not having a restless mind or having pain in the body. That's not what the Buddha said. The cause of suffering is not having a cold or not sort of having sore knees, or the cause of suffering is not being unable to eat what you want in the evening. It's not the cause of suffering. But so this craving is the cause of suffering, this doing is the cause of suffering. And you'll begin to understand this from your experience. Because the less you do, the more you let go, the more you start floating through life rather than swimming, the more ease you feel, the more peace you feel.
we start to feel happy. And this is a strange experience, because this takes you deeper into the meditation. When I started meditating, I didn't know anything about all these teachings of non-self and suffering and all that sort of stuff. It sounded really weird to me, and I didn't mind, because meditation made me happy. That was all I was caring for. All the philosophy bits didn't really make any sense. And to some of you it may not make any sense, because this is strange and weird, this is challenging you to the very core. You can't expect it to make sense at first, but nevertheless, we meditate because it feels good. We can see some positive results in our life. So we go deeper and deeper into that meditation. And the deeper you go, the closer you come to the, not the theory of non-self, to the experience of non-self. The experience of anatta. Many people can write books about non-self. They can have arguments about non-self. They can sort of say smart aleck things about non-self. But they've still got that sense of me in there. The sense of mind, the sense of an I, the sense of a doer. But as you meditate more and more, the experience of that sense of an identity, a self, someone in control, gets less and less and less. And you don't mind it getting less and less and less, because it feels good, it feels peaceful, it feels happy, it feels you're on a path to something worthwhile. So you meditate more and more and more, you get more and more peaceful. You get to such stages as like the body disappear. Even some people, they're sitting here and they can't feel their hands anymore. And that, for them, it's an amazing experience. They even look for their hands, they can't find them, as if they've been taken away, they're not there anymore. It's something has disappeared. Eventually, your whole body goes, and you can't feel it. For a lot of people, that may be scary at first. It's scary because now you're not in control of your body anymore. You can't feel it, you can't know what's happening to it. And that, for many, is frightening. Because we're concerned about our body, we want to feel it to check out to make sure it's all right. When you can't feel it, all of those mechanisms to check out are gone. It's the same why people are afraid when it starts, because they can't see what's going on, they don't know what's lurking in the corners. That's all it is, it's a sense of being out of control in the darkness. Here, we're in the darkness in the sense that your connection between your body has been cut off. You can't feel it anymore. However, even though it might seem scary, you're not in control of your body anymore, you don't know what's going on. Snake could be crawling on you right now, and you wouldn't know it. Ah! But the point is that you're so happy and so peaceful, you think it's really worthwhile. So you can actually let go of this body. And as you let go of this body, as I've been telling you in the meditations, you see like beautiful lights, and that's the mind appearing. You've let go of the body, you're in the realm of the mind. It feels good the longer you stay there. You realize you don't need to have a body. That you don't have to have a body. That this body is nothing to do with the essential you. What you're doing by those experiences again and again, you're realizing this body is not the self. Not yours, not me. Because you've got something else which is much more fundamental to your sense of identity and which is very beautiful, very peaceful, and you know this body is just like a heavy weight and a burden. But it's not essentially you. It's a very important insight that, to be able to let go of the identification with the body, because if you don't do that, you're going to be in an awful lot of suffering, worrying about your looks as you get old, worrying about, you know, your health as you get, you know, also get old and get sick, worrying about your impending death. People who really identify with their body and think this is them have an awful lot of suffering and struggle towards the end of their life. Because as if by nature is telling you, that they're taking away your possession, my body. Sure, they can take away my house, they can take away my car, the thieves can steal all my jewellery and my possessions, and the bank can take all my money, or if the bank doesn't do it, the tax office does. But okay, fair enough, but at least leave me with my body. But life is taking that away from you. Imagine if you realise it doesn't really belong to you, it's not the essential you. You can let it go very easily when you don't own it. This is what those realisations of non-self do. Not only do they give you happiness in the moment, they give you freedom forever. Freedom from concern about your body.
You know what it's like being young. You're so concerned about your looks and how you appear to other people. Young men have to be attractive. Young women have to be very attractive. And it gets so much stress and turmoil. I still remember the case of this 14-year-old girl who came to see me once. This is my first year in Perth. I wasn't all that good as a counsellor at that time. I think Ajahn Chacko was away. Her father rang up. He had his 14-year-old girl who was having psychological problems. They'd been to see a therapist, been to see the school counsellor. Nothing worked. She was suicidal, very depressed. Can a monk, sort of last resort, you know, can a monk see her? So I said, yeah, okay, bring her along. And so she sat in front of me. And I asked, what's your problem? You know, what's the matter? And, you know, it took a while to get it out of her, but her problem was, she confessed, that her nose was too big. It's true. Poor 14-year-old girl. She had the idea her nose was too big. And I looked at her, and because I was a scientist before, and I can't sort of, monks can't touch women, nuns can't touch men, I did a sort of quick calculation of her nose, quick measurements, and then I did a, you know, quick sort of record of all the other noses I'd seen in my life. And I told her back, I said, actually, I think your nose is pretty standard. You know, it's not sort of extreme on either case. It's not too big, it's not too small, it's not the prettiest nose I've seen, but certainly not the ugliest, it's just a nose, that's all. It's like every other nose, it's got two holes in the bottom. And what do you expect? It's just a nose. However, being scientific didn't really make any difference. For her nose was too big, and after an hour of trying to counsel her, she left as bad as when she came in. I didn't succeed. But it really taught me a lesson, just, you know, for young people, just little things like that create huge problems for us. It's not just that, it's just, you know, whenever you get sort of, you know, lump in your body somewhere, or sort of some growth on your skin, you got cancer. Cancer's coming. Coming, it's coming. It's like some sort of ghost or like some sort of demon which is coming to take away our most prized possessions. Whenever we get sick, we go to see the doctor and they give the results afterwards. It's, you know, even worse than getting your results after an exam at school. This is your body. You can always retake your exams, but my goodness, it's my body. I'm getting sick, I'm dying, I'm getting old. Why is it that people suffer that way? It's only your body, that's all. It's not yours. You'd have a lot less suffering, so much more peace and happiness in your life if we realize that we just have this body on rent, on loan from nature. When nature wants to take it back, it can take it back. You're not so concerned. This matter of life and death is not a matter of life and death. It's not so important anymore. If you die, okay, you die. If you get sick, okay, you get sick. But it's not so vital to you. It's only when we identify with that body we get into big troubles. Make use of it, care for it, but don't identify with it. And this is one of the things which come up when you meditate. You get that deep in meditation, your experience becomes very clear that this body is not you. And that gives you a lot of freedom. Freedom from the fear of aging, freedom from the fear of sickness, and freedom from the fear of even physical death. You know, you've done that many times, it's only the body dying, it's not you. So you can let it go. So often, that, you know, part of my job as a monk is to go to see people who are dying. Like you, you're all dying. So life is a terminal disease, or someone said that life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Which is more to the point. So sometimes you see people in the last stages when they're terminally ill and they're about to die, you know, one or two days to go. And some people you see them struggling to the very end and it's just so sad. You tell them to let go, it's just, you know, not your body, but they can't do that because they haven't trained themselves. They can't just change a whole lifetime of way of looking at things. But people have reflected upon that and they have done meditation. They've seen it for themselves. Oh, it's such a wonderful time. It's like, you know, the end of a concert, the great finale, which is the most moving part of any symphony. It's great, they die so well and so beautifully. And it's an inspiring moment. It's a much better way to go than to be struggling to the very last, clinging on to life, because you're afraid of letting go. So it's one of the great benefits of understanding that degree of non-self, that you aren't your body. If you go into this nimitta, this realm of the mind, but more than that, you just find out how much peace it comes from letting go of this doer, this will. Because that is even more of a pain than this having a body. Because when we do something and it goes wrong, we start feeling guilty, as if it's our fault. And you meet many, many cases of people who've got low self-esteem because they think of themselves as failures in life. How many of you, there's only one or two days left of this retreat, how many of you think of yourselves as failures in meditation? Because you haven't got jhana yet. And sometimes people get tough on themselves, they beat themselves up, I can't do this meditation, I can't do anything in life. And it's just that way that we get these guilt trips up, because we really think that we're in control of this. So we did something wrong, or we did something right, and then we get proud. There's no pride, there's no guilt needed at all, because there's nobody in there. The doer is completely conditioned. If you don't get into jhana this week, it's not your fault, it's my fault. For not brainwashing you enough. It's not my fault, it's my teachers for not teaching me how to brainwash people properly. But whatever else it is. But after a while, you know, you start to find out just this doer business. It's just cause and effect, that's all. There's nobody in there to do things. There was an experiment which was done a few years ago, and I remember this because I was just writing about it before I came up to this retreat, by this Professor Benjamin Libet at the University of California, San Francisco, who was actually trying to measure the occurrence of will and actually find out just how that corresponds to, you know, the brain. Now, where does will actually come from in the brain? Or does will start the brain moving, or does the brain concoct will? So he devises a very ingenious experiment. He got actually people to look at this digital clock. And when they decided just to flex their wrist, close and open, close and open, when they decided to flex their wrist, they would mentally note on this digital clock, you know, show the seconds of time. So they would actually record when they opened their wrist, when they decided, when the volition became conscious. Because you can actually see yourself, you can actually experience choice, you can see will happening if you look very carefully. You can actually see that moment when you decide sort of to cough, or you decide to get up after meditation. It's not that difficult to be aware of choice, of will. So they could actually perceive their will happening the moment they decided to flex their wrist, and then they sort of know at that time. But at the same time, they had all these electrodes on their skull which measured what's called the readiness potential, which is when the brain starts moving. Before any action, you can see the blood going to certain parts of the brain, or the neurotransmitters starting to fire, and you can check that out to the millisecond when that occurs. And the point was, I wanted to try and find out which one comes first, the brain or the will. And they managed to, I'm just reading about the other day, they used some electric sensors on the skin so they could actually time the reaction time when they felt something and when they actually thought they felt something. And they sort of took that into consideration, because sometimes you may notice something on the clock, there's some sort of reaction time, and that has to be taken into consideration. They did many, many times, a huge statistical analysis, and what they found very clearly, without any shadow of doubt, the brain moves first and volition comes next, with about 200 milliseconds after the brain moves. So when you're aware of your choosing, that point where you see will happening is already too late. It's happening. You are just seeing not the initiator of the process, but part of the causal sequence. Because that's early on in the whole process of doing something, we mistakenly assume that that is the cause. This part of the process is actually assumed to be what initiates it. We think we did this, but
you didn't at all.
Fascinating to see that in action. Because that challenges us and goes against what we want to see, what we want to believe. We want to be in control, because this is the most frightening thing of all. Our Western democracies are supposed to give you the freedom to choose.
Yes, no freedom there at all. You're manipulated.
That's all politicians know. They know how to manipulate people. So do advertisers. So do senior monks. This is the way I used to manipulate Ajahn Chakra when I was second monk. Because, you know, in our order ways of doing things, the senior monk, whoever he is, he's always the one who makes the final decision. They're the one who gives the talk. The other monks sit nice and quietly. When I was first a monk, I used to sit so quietly, and, you know, because I was number two monk, and Ajahn Chakra, the senior monk, he used to do all the talking. When people would come, he'd give the talks. When they'd ask questions, he'd do the answering. Just like these other monks here, they sit very quietly. And so, you know, I'd just be sitting there, and it happened that, I think the first time Ajahn Chakra went over to Thailand, just a bit of a rest, and I had to look after the shop, look after the people, and I started talking, and this 14-year-old girl came up to me. "It's amazing," she said, out of complete shock and awe. "You can speak." She said, "For all these months of coming here, I thought you were mentally retarded." That's what she said. So the monks next to me are not mentally retarded. They're very, very good monks. But I managed to learn how to get my own way. Again, through sort of conditioning, through brainwashing. Because what happened, because I was, you know, my job for that monastery was doing the building, and I would say to Ajahn Chakra, "So why don't you build a hut up on the hill over there?" And as you remember him, he'd always say, "Don't be ridiculous." Favourite sayings, "Don't be ridiculous, Ajahn Brahm." And that's what he would say. Now I was smart. I wouldn't push the issue, because I knew enough about the mind. I'd been meditating long enough. I knew how things worked. I said, "Oh, okay, very good." And I'd leave it for about a week or 2 weeks. And when his mind had forgotten, because he had so many other things to think about, I'd mention it again, just out of the blue. I said, "Why don't we build a hut on the hill over there?" And again, he would say, "That's a stupid idea, don't be ridiculous." "Okay, I'll leave it." And it happened all the time, every time, 100% success rate. It'd be 2 or 3 weeks later on, I'd be walking with him somewhere, and out of the blue he would say, "No, I think we should build a hut on the hill over there." And to him, he thought it was his idea. Because I'd always say afterwards, "That's a really good idea of yours, that's really smart." People in authority, they like to be sort of built up. Just like I do. But the point was there, that what I'd done is I planted a seed in him, I brainwashed him. You plant the seed in a person, but you don't push it, otherwise the seed is covered with negativity and it can't grow. You plant the seed in there, and then they keep thinking about it, even subconsciously, it goes through their mind. And if it is a good idea, if it stands up to the subconscious scrutiny, you may have to reinforce it one or two times, after a while it comes up, "Yeah, that is a good idea." And it becomes his idea. The interesting thing was, he thought it was his idea. I knew it was my idea. But now, all the ideas I have, because I've told that story to all my monks, I'm not quite sure whose idea. This is how you get conditioned. And now this is fascinating to see, because what's happening here, you think it's you doing these things, but you realise you're not. There's a lot of web of conditioning coming up here. This is fascinating. Now this is scary. Because if you really take that on board, that you're not the person who wills, it changes your whole life, number one. And it also takes away this identification of who you are. Because again, we measure ourselves by our successes in life and our failures. And when we measure ourselves with those successes and failures, we become those successes and failures. People commit suicide because they think they are the failure. They get so proud and arrogant because they think they are the success. It's them who did this, and they deserve all the praise. But when you actually see very clearly,
it's actually cutting away all of that. What I'm trying to say is it's worthwhile letting go of that sense of I am the doer. You'll be a much freer person. But anyhow, as you meditate, you have to do that. Because what you do, you get so close. When you get nimitta experiences, beautiful lights in the mind, you're so peaceful that you're not doing anything. But you realize almost intuitively there's a little bit more to go. Sometimes I've explained it like the nimitta, this beautiful light which is there, and after a while in the center of that is like a little door's opening saying, come in, it's brought amazing bliss. And it's as if it beckons you in, but you don't want to go in because you know you have to give up something to get through there. And this is what you have to give up, your doer. The sense that I am the one who's doing things. At the stage of the nimitta, the doer is quiet. It's not doing anything, but it's still there. The stage of the nimitta is the potential to do. If you look upon the doer as some sort of general, which is a very good metaphor for the doer, the general inside of you, the one who's doing all the orders and commands, is in charge of everything, then at the stage of the nimitta, the general is silent. It can't give any commands. If it gives any commands or orders, that nimitta goes straight away. You feel so peaceful. You're peaceful because the general is quiet. You're not moving. You're still. However, that general is always in the background there. He can say something if he wants to. And that gives you a feeling of security. You can still do something if you really need to. But to go into the jhanas, the general has to disappear. Because in the jhanas, you can't do anything. In the jhanas, the doer completely disappears. It's just the peace of the thing, the joy of the thing. Just the bliss becomes so enticing that you're willing, you're able just to let go of that general. Even though there's a sense of fear there. I think I've already mentioned that fear is the biggest obstacle of these deep stages of meditation. Because the fear of you disappearing. The greatest fear of a human being is themselves being taken away. As you just allow yourself to go, it's just too much fun. You experience these wonderful states, usually last for many hours. And the point is, this is giving you invaluable data about non-self. What anatta is meaning. And without that data, you can't really get your mind around it. Because when you come out afterwards, you realize for all those hours that you weren't there. Or rather, the doer wasn't there. You couldn't do anything. Now, there's a lot of difference between being still, in other words, not doing anything, but still having the potential to do. The sense of doing hasn't really disappeared, it's just stopped for a while. In the same way, it's a very different thing to see me sitting here, not still, not moving, doing meditation, and then suddenly seeing me completely disappear and vanish out of existence. And you think, that's really weird. Imagine looking at one of the monks, sitting so still for an hour, and then suddenly their body, their life completely disappears. They're gone, they vanish, like some Superman. Now that's really weird. But that's what happens when you get into the jhanas. This doing business. It was still, it wasn't moving when you're at the nimitta stage. But now, my goodness, it went. Disappeared completely. And mindfulness, alertness, consciousness is still there. What's happening there is you get the data which is incontestable, which is irresistible, you can't be the doer. This thing we call will is not anything to do with you. That might be striking, but it has amazing effects. It means you're no longer afraid of what other people think of you, because they usually judge you by what you do. When you realize that's nothing to do with you, then you're at peace. Success and failure don't mean anything to you anymore. You can just really relax and enjoy yourself. When I give talks, I don't really care whether you like them or not, because I am not giving the talk.
this talk, and put it on there, this is not done by Ajahn Brahm. This talk is completely conditioned. The copyright belongs to the Buddha. It's Ajahn Chah was the last one to do the brainwashing and all the other stuff. So it's his fault. I gave a talk some years ago. The reason why I tell, you know, the reason why I tell jokes in my talks is my father used to tell jokes. He was always telling jokes. And because he was always telling jokes, I got conditioned by him. Got brainwashed by him. So don't, please don't complain about my jokes. It's not my fault at all, it's my father's. It's his fault. And it's true. I remember him going around, I don't know, the last time I told this one. And when we were going around, we went to see his, my uncle, my brother, and he told me, and I told others afterwards, about a friend of his who had a motorbike accident. And had to be taken to hospital. In those days, actually it even happens these days sometimes, because they weren't careful. In the operating table, they took off the wrong leg. Had to be amputated. And as soon as they found out, these days actually, they actually put, one of the monks had a knee operation, they actually put a cross on the leg. He came back, had an akagata from the hospital, had a little X on his leg. So what that's for? He said, so I had to put on a, that on, he said, so the doctor was now which leg to operate on. Even modern technology, what they do is a faulty pen, put an X on the slot. But anyway, this poor fellow had to go straight back into the operating table again to get another one which was had to be taken off. Lost both his legs. It's really just crazy. But he, the worst part of it was he took them to court. He sued the hospital. And he lost his case. He lost. He didn't have a leg to stand on. See, that's a joke. That came from my father. It's nothing to do with me. Those silly jokes. And that's what anatta is. So if people laugh, I don't get, oh, you know, I'm a great storyteller. People that sit there with a glum face, I don't think, oh dear, I better not tell that one again. You don't get embarrassed, you don't get upset, you don't get proud, because you know that's not you. There's an old story which I gave some years ago about this, and it's called The Driverless Bus. It's one of the favourite stories, and it's a good one to retell, because once you get a metaphor which is so accurate, you can actually work it many, many ways and get so much juice out of it. Every time you look at it, you can squeeze a bit more out. And that sort of simile, The Driverless Bus, is like this. You get very upset at times because you find you're not in control. You want happiness, but do you get it? You want peace, you're trying to guide your life, you struggle very hard with your relationships, you say with a relationship, you try your very best and it all falls apart. Why? What did I do wrong? You do your life, you eat sort of brown rice and vegetarian food and lots of greens and you get cancers. What did I do wrong? You exercise, you do yoga, and then you get back trouble. What did I do wrong? See, whatever happens in life, it never works out perfectly. So you want to, a lot of times we want to try and fine-tune our will, our doer, to make sure it never makes that same mistake again. So next time, you do it right. A lot of time that's why we get reborn, so next time you'll do it right. If you had your time again, would you want it? If I could put you back to the time when you were, say, 10 or 12 or 14 or 18, would you like to go back there and do it all over again? You might think, oh, if I did it again, I wouldn't make that mistake, I'd do it this way, I wouldn't make that mistake, I'd do it this way. I'll guarantee you would make, not the same mistake, you'd make different mistakes. It still wouldn't work out. The point is, we think it would, and that's why we keep getting reborn, to get another try. Another try, another try, another try, another try. Think that one day we'll get it right. It's like, again, just Ajahn Jaka, one of his favourite stories of Sufis, who was this fellow called Mullah Nasruddin, who was sitting in front of a big pile of chili peppers. His face red, his eyes streaming, and his nose streaming as well, as you do when you eat too much chili. He was putting chili after chili into his mouth and chewing them. And his friend said, what are you doing that for? Why are you torturing yourself? He said, oh, I'm looking for the sweet one. And that's what life is. You're looking for the sweet one. But chilies are hot, they're not sweet. This is what life is. We want to try and make it something it's not. And we think that we're wrong. So life is sometimes like being in this bus. And you know, go through beautiful scenery, wonderful territory, and you love it so much. We look out the window, oh, this is so delightful. The birds are singing, the sun is shining. Oh, can't you please stop? At least slow down. I want to enjoy these moments. And when you fall in love, you know, when you have the first child, when you're being up, you don't want it to go so fast. You're enjoying it. When you're on holiday, you know, you go over to Europe or some nice island somewhere, you just lay under the coconut trees. Oh, it's so wonderful. Slow down. So you tell the bus driver, please slow down. And what does the bus driver, you, it seems to go so fast. In fact, sometimes when life is fun, it seems to go faster than it should do. And you wonder, what's wrong? Why can't these moments of bliss last? And other times you're going through a lot of pain and disappointment and frustration, even sort of inner torture. And you want to get out of there. Why does this pain last so long? Why am I so depressed? Even during the meditation retreat, sometimes you can't get yourself peace, but I want to get out of here. What am I doing wrong? You ask yourself. You've got to find out who that doer is, first of all. So you want to actually teach this doer, this driver of your bus, you know, how to drive properly. Okay, now listen, driver. Doer, me, when I'm having fun, slow down. It's not okay. When it's not going right, now you get out of there as soon as you can. Speed up. But first of all, you've got to find that bus driver, the doer, you. And it's what happens in meditation. We get so close into ourselves, we actually find out who this doer is. Who's in charge of you? Who's driving your life? Who's driving this meditation? And when you eventually get out of your seat, the place where you usually sit, it's your life, and you go into your deep meditation, then you actually find the driver's seat, the driver of your bus. And it's there, and I say all insight is shocking, because you find that driver's seat is empty, it's vacant, there's no one in there. You are a driverless bus. When you notice that, you see that, there's only one thing you can do. You just go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. You stop complaining about the meditation. Great meditation, beautiful meditation. You stop complaining about things which happen to you in life. You get sacked, you get another job. About people dying, people being born. When there's no driver in that bus, who is there to complain to? You stop shouting. You stop all desire and ill will. You're free. You just sit down there and just enjoy the journey. You let go. Imagine about that. You're letting go and just enjoying the journey. Taking it as it comes. There's no one to complain to anymore. It's a driverless bus. You see there's nobody in there. Now this is what we mean by non-self, or half of non-self. The doer, that which controls, is not you. I'm not saying the doer doesn't exist. Choice is, but you're giving it an identity it does not deserve. Choice comes from cause and effects. With mindfulness you can see why you did this, why you did that, why you didn't do something else. Why you chose the food you did today, why you chose the breakfast, why you didn't choose the breakfast, why you chose to eat this or not eat that, why you choose to sit out in one particular place in the garden or sit out in the hall. Really, you have to do that. It's just cause and effect. And when you actually let go of that controller, you can really relax and just really flow just with things as they happen. It's being like this observer. It's not the doer, but it's the knower. When you go into those deep meditations, they're so blissful when the doer disappears. Because the doer creates all this movement, which stops you being happy. Not only is seeing the non-self of the doer actually true, but it's also blissfully true as well. Truth is happiness, thank goodness. Delusion is suffering. There's one way you can know truth. If truth causes you problems, if it's unpleasant,
it cannot be truth. If this idea of non-self is causing you problems, you're not understanding it. It's some other idea, other than the one I'm presenting. But the real experience of non-self, of especially non-doing, is beautiful. It gives you so much freedom and so much happiness. You're free at last. When this disappears, this doer business, it's still not the end of non-self, yeah? But at least you can actually see a lot of what's really going on. You can see actually why we go from life to life, what the stream of consciousness is, or rather, instead of what the stream of consciousness is, what motivates it? What's the force behind the stream of consciousness? What keeps you going? Not just in this life, but from life to life. It's just doing. When you're doing something, you're moving. You're moving forward into something else. If at the end of your life, you're still doing something. That is the force which will push you into a new life. That's what keeps the stream of consciousness going on and on and on and on and on. The doing. You can understand how that works. When a person dies, they still have craving, they still have wants, they still have something to do. Then that will be one of the motivations for a future life. What do you want to do next? Sometimes people, I just want to be peaceful, I want to be happy. Then you go and do the peaceful, happy business in some sort of heaven realm. Sometimes people miss their partner. Oh, I just want to be with my old wife again. I want to be with my husband in the next life as well. That desire is enough to get you reborn together again. You follow each other around. But maybe you've got unfinished business. That person, they gave you such a hard time in this life. I'm going to get my own back. That will also create the force for a new rebirth. Desire is half of it. The other one is like what we call the karmic wherewithal. In the same way, if you're going to want to go off to, say, Europe for a holiday, you want to see London and Paris, wanting to go is only half of the course of getting to Paris. The other half, of course, is having the money to buy the ticket. The money to buy the ticket, the wherewithal, is called karma. You've got the karmic resource to get to where you want to go. And the second is you want to go there. When those two causes come together, you have the karmic causes in place, you've got the money, the karmic money if you like, and you've got the will to go there. With those two together, that's how you get reborn into that particular state. That's how you get to Paris. The same process works. So that's what drives this stream of consciousness. And that's why drives us, you know, to get married, to have a partner, to do this and to do that. We're driving ourselves, a karmic wherewithal, and also a desire to do. And of course, that is challenging to give that up, because we associate doing with being. Even you call this cup over here, you don't call this a being, this cup. Why do we say this hasn't got life? We don't know if it's got consciousness. It may feel what I'm talking about it and get sort of a bit ashamed or to be proud at last he's talking about me. But we think it's dead because it doesn't do anything. Sometimes that's a definition of being dead, of not being here, you're not doing anything. In the same way, you can understand that this is like dying, letting go of the self. You're not doing anything anymore. It's like a dying of the ego. It's fearful at first, but it's nothing to fear because it's beautiful and it's blissful. Experience the less you do, the more happy you are, the more peaceful you are, the more joyful you feel. Experience that yourself in your meditation.
But then, actually, what is that stream of consciousness? What is it? What motivates? What pushes it from life to life? What actually it really is? It's just this flow of cause and effect phenomena called consciousness, called knowing. Because the next thing you start to investigate through the experience of jhana is just pure knowing. What is knowing? First of all, knowing being the mind. You have to actually get to understand what this mind is, first of all. The first time you see the mind is in nimittas and then in jhanas. That's where you really get close to this thing we call mind, as an experience. Simile I give is of an emperor. Again, an emperor is a good simile for the mind, because this is not just a general in command, a commander-in-chief, but it's also the essential thing behind you, the thing in chief, the knower, that which is listening to me now, that which knows the thoughts, that which can see, the one behind the eyes, between the ears as it were, the one who's registering everything, that which knows. Trouble is, that which knows is just so caught up with just the world of senses. It's like this emperor with 5 pieces of clothes. The emperor with boots which go right up to his knees. Who's got trousers which cover his waist and go beyond the top of his boots, so he can't see anything of his legs. He's got a jacket which covers his waist, covers his neck and goes down to his wrists. He's got gloves which cover his hands and go halfway up his arms, so all his arms are covered as well. And he's got a helmet which goes completely over his head, can't even see his eyes, and goes down over his shoulders. Every inch, square millimetre of his body is covered by the 5 garments. The boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, and the helmet. So we can't really see if the emperor is a man or a woman. We can't see what nationality they are. We can't even know if they're old or young. Because all we see is their clothes, their outer covering. In that simile, the 5 outer garments are the senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. The 5 senses. They cover our mind so much. We think we might know exactly what's going on underneath, but we don't. We don't know that common sense of Aristotle. We only know the 5 senses. But if you can take the 5 garments off that emperor, so that there's no more seeing, there's no more hearing, there's no more smelling, tasting, there's no more touching anymore. All those 5 senses are subdued. So you can't see, you can't hear, you can't even feel your body anymore. When you take those 5 garments off, what you're left with is the mind, the pure mind. And hopefully you've figured out that what I'm talking about now, again, is experiences of nimittas and jhanas. When nimittas or jhanas appear, you cannot hear anything. You can't even feel your body. All those things are gone. You've taken off the 5 garments, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, which cover up the mind. And for the first time you can actually see what this mind is. After a while, through familiarity, you understand what this mind is. You know what the emperor is. The emperor hasn't got gender. The mind is neither male nor female. It's not even homo sapiens, which is why that mind can get reborn as an animal or any other realm of existence. You see this. The mind is completely apart from anybody. There's no such. That's why we've all got something in common. That's why that when you come on a retreat, there's no gender. We're working with our mind, which has no gender. In those jhana realms, no gender. Gender stops with having a body. The mind is something completely different. But you start to see that knowing, you look at it even closer. A stream of consciousness, moment to moment, flowing on, just like in this day, in this retreat, consciousness has flowed from day to day, to day to day. It's like this stretch of beach. You look and see that stretch of beach is continuous. There's no holes or pits in that stretch of beach. Like a continuous flow of consciousness. But, when you look more closely, when the mindfulness increases, it's like getting a magnifying glass and looking closely at that beach. You find that that beach is all made up, not of something continuous, but of grains of sand. individual pieces of silica. And you go closer, and you see there's quite a lot of gaps between those grains of sand. If you look very close, you find those grains of sand aren't even touching. There's space between them, emptiness between them. There's no essential sandness going from one grain to the next, which gives it any sense of continuity. This is actually how you see this knowing. You see there's only blips of knowing, and after the blip of knowing, completely disappears, and there's nothing. Another blip of knowing, and then nothing. Spaces between each conscious moment. Now what I'm saying here is not theory. This is what happens when you look in these jhanas, when you're familiar with them, when you see pure consciousness, pure knowing, pure mind, again and again and again. So what actually is essential to this knowing? If there was something essential there, permanent, always there, the heart of the matter, you would be able to see something going across the gaps. When you don't see anything going across the gaps, then you realize there's no essential heart identity to this knowing. Even knowing is not you. It's just a process of nature, which when we don't see it clearly enough, we think is us. The other student, somebody wanting to me to remind them of, was like a string of beads. One bead next to the other, but there's not a string going from one bead, through one bead to the next. There's nothing going from one moment of consciousness to the next moment of consciousness. Just a cause and effect relationship, that's all. But nothing essential. Because there's nothing essential there, it means everything is up for change. Nothing is beyond change. Everything can be altered. Everything can stop. The fact that everything can stop has profound significance. Sometimes people ask, what's the real difference between the Buddhist idea of the stream of consciousness and the soul? It's very, very little difference. But the difference, which is very, very little, creates huge consequences. That's why for most people, when you experience past lives, or you actually experience your death floating out of the body, to all extents and purposes, you think you are a soul. You can actually feel it. That's what it looks like. But just like this, the beach of sand, you look more closely with refined mindfulness and you see there's nothing there. And that has, again, huge consequences. It means you can stop knowing. And the whole point of the further jhanas is to practice letting go of knowing. Second jhana, a lot of knowing has disappeared. Third jhana, even more knowing has disappeared. Here you're getting into refined mystic states, which not many people understand or even realize their significance. As far as the, say, the Christian mystics would go, getting into a first jhana or even a second jhana if they were lucky, for them it was as if they completely disappeared. What was left was God, the knowing, the ultimate knowing. So that's what it feels like in those jhanas. The doer is gone. You identify the doer as being the me, the I. You get into those states, you think that's unity with the knowing, the ultimate knowing. Because it's so still and so powerful, it's very easy to make that assumption. But then you start to see God disappearing. See the knower fading away, stage by stage, in these jhanas, in these immaterial realms. You go to such stages like an unbounded, unlimited consciousness. The first arupa jhana. Sorry, unlimited space. First arupa. What does that actually mean, unlimited space? In a little book which I gave this simile to try and get these experiences back to something which people can relate to. And I got it back down to the experience of timelessness when you're in the present moment awareness during your meditation. When you get to timelessness, there's no time there at all. Time doesn't make any sense anymore. But you've got all the time in the world. Now that experience of being in the present moment, whether it's an hour, 2 hours, doesn't really make any difference. And you don't feel constrained by time anymore. It's timeless, and at the same time, no time. All the time in the world, but no time. It seems a contradiction, but that's a very good description of getting the present moment. It's what happens in unlimited or unbounded, unmeasured space. You have all the space in the world, but at the same time, there's no space. When space disappears, then there's all the space in the world. Like when time disappears, there's all the time in the world. That's what unlimited space is. Space concept is transcended. The next thing is transcend consciousness. The second arupa state. These are the finer jhanas. Where unlimited or unmeasured, unbounded consciousness. When there's no consciousness left, there's all the consciousness in the world. It's the same thing. Zero is the same as infinity in maths. When you start to do this, you start to see the infinity of consciousness is actually no consciousness. And that becomes your perception. And it very quickly goes into the third arupa, the perception of nothing. Nothing left at all. Now you're getting close to what this essence is, what Nirvana is. But now you're actually perceiving nothing. Nothing is still a perception. So now you have to go to the next stage, where perception starts to disappear. You're perceiving non-perception. All perception is gone. But you're perceiving non-perception. That's why if you look at it from in here, you're perceiving. If you're looking out there, you're not perceiving. That's why it's called the state of neither perception or non-perception. And then when that goes, when everything goes, that's called the state of cessation. That's where everything stops. When there's nothing left, like timelessness, is also everything. That's cessation, that's Nirvana, here and now. Can only be achieved through letting go of the sense of self. And abandoning the Buddha and abandoning the Nama. This is radical. You can't get more radical than that. It goes completely against the stream of the world. Absolutely 100%. Something different. So if you want to be a radical, then let go. Don't be like me when I was young. I was into being a hippie, being radical, being individual, going against what other people were doing. Anything my father said, I would do something different. That's called being radical. So one day I went to the shop and spent a lot of money on my green velvet trousers. My father's dead by now, but my mother didn't like them at all. And that made me, oh, that's really cool. And I was very proud of my green velvet trousers. I was an individual. I was the only one in the street who had green velvet trousers. But I went to one of these rock concerts, the Isle of Wight. And I went in my green velvet trousers. And I was devastated. I saw a couple of thousand other people in green velvet trousers. It's just another uniform. I wasn't individual at all. I was just associated with another type of being and person. So how much are we sheep? How much do we always sort of, you know, identify with something or someone? We follow others. We don't really be radical enough to go against the stream. Let's talk about anatta, going to the very depths. Just to give you a taste. Might seem frightening. And in the same way it seems frightening for a person who's been in prison for 30, 40 years, who said that now you can be free. You can leave your prison if you want. How many people would have the guts to leave after 30, 40 years inside a jail? When that's all they know. For many prisoners it's hard, they'd rather stay inside. But that's nothing compared to what you have to do. You've been inside the jail of the knower and the doer, not for 30 or 40 years, not for 30 or 40 hundred years, not for 30 or 40 hundred lifetimes, for immeasurable eons. Buddha said the doors of the deathless are open.
But how many people are willing to walk through?
You have to be coaxed, cajoled with a lovely stick of bliss better than sex. And that gets you through. So that's the talk today on anatta, non-self. Any questions or comments about that?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sure there will be. Yeah, one, two, officer. Yeah?
When the knower disappears, consciousness disappears.
Yeah.
Who is the one still watching?
No one is watching.
But he has already disappeared.
Yeah, the watcher has disappeared, no one is watching, the watching has disappeared. Everything is gone. Nothing left.
Okay?
Cool. Gone.
At the perception stage?
Perception's gone. Everything's gone. Nothing left.
But consciousness.
Consciousness, there's six types of consciousness, different types of knowing. There's knowing, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. That's one type of knowing. When you get into these jhanas, you actually separate these things out. You know what seeing is. Most of the time when we're seeing, it's not pure seeing. It's seeing and knowing. It goes together. We see and we know we see. The two are stuck together. When we hear, we know we hear. Two are stuck together. Smell, taste, we feel the body, we feel a sensation, we also know we feel. The two are stuck together. So a lot of times we don't actually know what knowing is. All we know is seeing knowing, hearing knowing, feeling knowing. That's all we experience. In the jhanas, then we know pure knowing. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, completely gone. Just got that knowing. Then we get an idea of what this consciousness process is. And how it is we get a sense of self-identity, because we don't know we know, we know we knew. I know I knew a few moments ago, and that gives the sense of self-identity. It's the whole process. We know something, and then we reflect upon it. I know I knew. And then I know I knew I knew. I know I knew I knew I knew I knew. We get this whole idea of continuity, the illusion of continuity. And this is actually what it appears like. Now, what actually happens is all that knowing starts to disappear. First of all, the five sense knowings disappear. We don't see, we don't hear, we don't smell, we don't touch, we don't feel in our body. And that's so much bliss. We get the understanding from that, if we're smart enough, that all this knowing business is a whole burden. Suffering. To know is to suffer. Consciousness, said the Buddha, is the cause of suffering. Now that's radical. But that's challenging, because the Buddha said that. When you actually find out, wow, what does he mean by that? It's not attachment to consciousness, it's actually consciousness itself. And it gives us the idea of why we let go, if even none. The knower lets go of itself. And the whole thing stops. So why do we stop? There's nothing left. But there was nothing there to begin with. So the illusion is broken. And that's why we can let go and allow things to cease. Bhava Nirodha Nibbana Vedanti Buddha from the Sanyutta Nikaya. The cessation of existence is Nibbana.
Can I
get
one more?
Go, yeah, because I'm giving you the work. Yeah. Yep.
Consciousness has disappeared. So who knows, or the perception even disappears, who knows?
No one knows.
Nirvana.
No one knows.
Because after this, nothing's there.
That's right. Nirvana is, but not the person who enters it. The path is, but no travel on it is seen. Who knows this right at the moment? Just a process, that's all. There's no person in there knowing this. Even the person thinking about this. Who's thinking this anyway? This is a process. So that's the illusion. Take that to be something solid, to be me, to be self. And I accept that you will not understand this. And I'm challenging you, but you've got enough respect for myself, and I can show you the suttas, enough respect for the Buddha, to see, hang on, there might be something in here. But what I'm doing there is I'm planting a seed. In the same way that I told Ajahn Chakra, why don't you pull the house over there? Don't be ridiculous. That's what many of you are thinking when I'm saying. That's ridiculous. But I'm planting the seed. And I might have to say it again a few times the next retreat when I'm in Singapore when you hear this. And then after a while you come up to me and say, there's no one in here. Yeah, right. So when you plant the seed there, actually, that seed is important, because when you do get into these deep states of meditation, first of all, it allows you to let go, gives you more confidence to let go and go deep in meditation. Number two, when you do let go into meditation, you have the framework to understand what's going on. Remember, insights are not seeing what you expect to see. Insights, they challenge you. They throw out all your comfortable old ideas, and you're just completely sort of, wow, what's happened? Whole citadels of your views get completely destroyed. The achievement of streaming, which I'll talk about tomorrow, Seven Stages of Enlightenment, is just like a bomb going off with your mind. Just all the things you thought were just so solid, which you lived by, which you thought existed, which you assumed was obvious, the whole framework of your being has been destroyed. And that's really strange. That's why when you're streaming it, you change your lineage. You're a different being now. You're a noble one. And that's completely different than who you were before. And that's why the achievement of enlightenment is no small thing. It's not some idea that pops up into your head, oh, now I'm enlightened. It's a huge cataclysm of the mind. So, the seed is there now. I've planted a bomb. You're going to be in trouble. I know, this is really weapons of mass destruction. Yes, sorry, yeah, the back here. I'll Peter first, yeah. Then. Yeah.
I remember your quotation once of William Blake, also my favorite poet. He quoted in Singapore once, in this line, a grain of sand in your palm.
Yeah.
To
see a world in a grain. That's right, to see a world in a grain of sand, the heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour.
Anyway, another beautiful quote from C.S. Eliot. I think it has something to do with your talk this morning.
Oh, wait a second.
Beginning is the end, the end is the beginning.
Yeah. It is, yeah. The beginning is the end. All ending.
In the fourth part of the tradition.
Gone. That's the thinking. Things gone. The end of things. That's what Adam Charles used to say. The only thing he was interested in were things which had an end. Like, study never has any end. But when things cease, they have an end. Working has no end. Having money has no end. Eating has no end. Sleeping has no end. So in your life, what can you do which really has an end? So this is what has an end. Ending samsara, finish the last. They say like an arahant, I'll mention some words, like a workman waiting for their wages. At last you've done the job, now you can really relax. Okay, Pauline. And now I've got to go back to Rod, because this question I've learned enough, is it?
When it comes to enlightenment and a transcendent identity and mind, and that they're back in meditation, to people looking at them, they're still here on the planet alive. How do they come back to that meditation?
They don't come back, they're gone.
So it's not a death.
Okay, yeah, that's, when a person becomes fully enlightened, the arahat, okay, then seeing cessation, seeing the end, seeing that there's nobody in here, when they see there's nobody in here, there's no doer, there's nothing to do, craving stops then, and all they've got left is this, their life faculty, the cause and effect which got this being going in the first place in this lifetime, they have to live out the rest of their years. Only if there's something useful to do. In other words, not selfish reasons anymore, but complete selflessness, loving kindness, metta. Which is why the only thing really to do once one is blind is to teach the Dhamma. It's the only thing worthwhile, everything else has got no meaning anymore. If you can't teach the Dhamma, there's no point anymore. Which is why the people, once they're enlightened, even if they're lay people, they didn't come enlightened as well, but be careful, because this is what will happen to you. You've got to join the Sangha pretty quickly. In Sri Lanka they say within that day, but usually they say within 7 days, or you die. No reason to live anymore. the will to live has gone, unless you've got something to do. So if you become enlightened in the next day or two, it doesn't matter whether there's any room in Sister's Monastery or not. We have to do that, otherwise poof, you're gone. But usually they die in really nice ways. There's one story of this general, and he just won a big battle for the king. So the king said, for the next 7 days you can have whatever you want. And he said, what I always wanted is special dancer, the most beautiful dancer in the whole kingdom. And he wanted to do this amazing special dance, which he had to fast for 7 days before she could do this special dance.